Welcome to Talking History, a series of talks from the Farnham U3A World History Group. The views expressed in this talk are representative of the views held at the time of the material being discussed. They do not necessarily represent the views of the speaker, the Farnham U3A World History Group, nor the team at the Mr. T Podcast Studio. In this talk, David Simpson tells us about the Border Reavers. Although romanticised in ballads and by Sir Walter Scott, these bandits plundered the borderlands between England and Scotland from the late 13th century to the Union of the Crowns in 1603.
Today's talk tells the story of the Border Reavers across the more than 300 years of their existence as they raided across the English and Scottish frontier. It examines their actions, how the Crowns responded, as well as recounting tales of their most famous exploits before exploring their legacy today. Imagine the scene. The dull thunder of hooves sent fear into the hearts of the family gathered around the fire in their small cottage. Firelight reflected the scared eyes of the women and children as the galloping horses came ever nearer. The men, swords in hand, stood guard at the bolted door, hoping that the riders would go past, having seen nothing in the humble surroundings worth taking. As the sounds faded into the distance, a collective sigh of relief breathed into the room. Their neighbours would not be so lucky. This scene was a regular occurrence in the Scottish borderlands for over 300 years, from the late 13th to the early 17th century, when the Border Reavers were on the prowl. So who were the Reavers? They are the border raiders who terrorised both sides of the frontier. To some they were heroes, to others villains. Whatever your opinion, their legacy remains today in the fortified dwellings, ballads and traditions which are still alive in the borders. And this, as we will see, is very much a personal area of interest for me. There was no social stigma attached to reaving. It was simply an accepted way of life. The reaver came from every social class, from peasant to peer. The reaver was a skilled horseman and guerrilla fighter, practiced in those fine arts of arson, kidnapping and murder. Now, it'll come as no surprise to those here, the relationships between England and Scotland have on occasions been, shall we say, strained. But that's nothing compared to the cross-border shenanigans that the Reavers got up to. And it wasn't always England versus Scotland. Often it was Scots versus Scots and English versus English. The borderers always owed their allegiance to their blood relatives first and to their country second. What does reaver mean? Well, reeve means to raid in Middle English, while reeve as a verb means to plunder or rob, as in be reaved, means to be robbed of a loved one. We owe the term Border Reaver to Sir Walter Scott in his anthology Minstrelsy of the Scottish Borders. Earlier writers referred simply to bandits. Scott has ever romanticised the borders, but it is a phrase that caught hold of popular imagination and is the accepted term today. The Reavers were the product of the constant Anglo-Scottish wars that reduced the border area to a wasteland. The continuing threat of renewed conflict between the two countries offered little incentive to arable farming. Why bother planting crops if they may be burned before they could be harvested? The raising of livestock, however, was a totally different matter, and so rustling became the principal business of the border families. Raiding became an important way of life. Treaties and truces that were agreed between England and Scotland did not stop this way of life and did not quiet the frontier. No householder could sleep secure. No cattle could be left unguarded. The hill land was dominated by the sword and the flame. From the First War of Scottish Independence in 1296 until 1603 in the Union of the Crowns, the borderlands of England and Scotland suffered from regular armed raids of the Border Reavers. The raiders were the armed bands of local lairds or clan chiefs on both sides of the Anglo-Scottish border, intent on taking hostages, rustling, livestock and wreaking damage on property. Bishop Leslie of Ross, and he's somebody who I'll be quoting quite a bit through this talk, gives the best explanation of the Borderers' philosophy. They have a persuasion that all property is common by the law of nature and is therefore liable to be appropriated by them in their necessity. The result of the raiding led to families on both sides of the border becoming intent on plundering their neighbours before the same was done to them. The attitudes of the English and Scottish governments towards these border families alternated from a velvet glove, when the Reavers served as the first line of defence against invasion, to an iron fist when their lawlessness became intolerable to the authorities. The absence of royal landholdings and the remoteness of the border region meant that law and order would devolve to the great northern families. Unfortunately, these families were often in conflict with the centralised powers of both England and Scotland, and usually in conflict with each other. And if there was ever any legal compensation to be paid to the victims of the raiding, then this was often defrayed out of the magnate's own pockets, which meant that the local lairds, to make good their losses, had an interest in using raiding to call back their expenses, and so the cycle rolled ever on. Now, the heyday of the Reavers was in the last 100 years of their existence in the 16th century, during the time of the House of Stuart in Scotland and the House of Tudor in England, and most of my talk will focus on that period. But to put things into perspective, here is a short history of the border years leading up to the accession of James VI of Scotland and I of England in 1603. In 1296, the Hammer of the Scots, Edward I, led a series of excursions into Scotland to assert his sovereignty, plunging both countries into 300 years of warfare. The First Scottish War of Independence ran from 1296 until 1328, although de facto independence for Scotland was achieved at the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314. The Second War of Independence, from 1332 until 1357, was more of a Scottish civil war, as while the English under Edward III were involved, they were backing one Scottish faction versus another. This war finally petered out in 1357, and a very uneasy peace settled over the border. But the peace was fraught, and relations between the two countries uneasy, to say the least. Outright war broke out several times, as England invaded Scotland, first under Richard II in 1385, and later Henry IV in 1400. The Scots retaliated later in the 15th century, with the taking of Berwick and Roxburgh in the 1460s. And then Edward IV of England retook Berwick in 1482. For a brief time, another peace of sorts broke out until the borders shook loose once again in the 16th century. This time, James IV of Scotland made the strategic mistake of invading Northumberland in 1513, resulting in decisive defeat at the Battle of Flodden Field, where 1,500 English lives were lost. But compare that to the over 10,000 Scots who were killed, including James IV himself. But worse was to come for the borders in the period known as the Rough Wooing. The Rough Wooing ran for 8 years, between 1543 and 1551. It was an armed conflict with the intent of ensuring that Mary, Queen of Scots, a mere baby at the start of the war, would marry Henry VIII's son, the future Edward VI, and so unite the two countries under the House of Tudors. Henry invaded Scotland and burnt his way through the borders as far as Edinburgh. The conflict even survived the death of Henry VIII, but slowly petered out into yet another uneasy peace that was only confirmed by the Union of the Crowns in 1603, not under the House of Tudor, but under the House of Stuart. All these wars were brutal to the borderlands. English and Scottish armies passed through the borders, leaving crops burned, castles and hovels alike put to the torch, and whole populations slaughtered. Besides the armies constantly marching across their lands, it was also a period of an unusual amount of rainfall, so much so that any crops that could be planted simply rotted away. If the land could not provide a living, therefore, then the local inhabitants would have to take what they wanted from their neighbours, and so raiding became a matter of life and death. If the soil could not provide, then the sword would. The Reavers were all inhabitants of that rugged territory that lies roughly 50 miles either side of the current England and Scottish borders, in the old counties of Berwickshire, Roxburghshire and Dumfriesshire in Scotland, Northumberland, Cumberland and Westmorland in England. Much of the border region is rugged open moorland, unsuitable for arable farming, but good for grazing. The arena of the Border Reivers are the Cheviot Hills. These form a natural barrier between England and Scotland and are wild, desolate and beautiful. It is largely treeless, with untold numbers of valleys, gullies and endless ridges of rough grass. The Cheviots then fall away on either side of the border to salt marshes, peat bogs and broad rivers that flow into green, wooded valleys. The Cheviots have provided a barrier to any invading army, even before the Romans built Hadrian's Wall slightly further south. After the Romans, the borderlands remained a buffer zone between England and Scotland. Over the centuries, there have been attempts to install some form of administrative order in this area, and in 1249, both sides of the border were divided into three marches per country, east, middle and west, each one administered by a separate warden of the march. But even this wasn't straightforward. Bordering the western marches was an area known as the Debatable Land, as it was frequently debated as to which side owned it. It was relatively small, at just 12 miles long and 4 miles wide, and was usually used as pasture for sheep and cattle. But when violent disputes arose, when anyone tried to create a permanent settlement, fed up with trying to police it, both the English and Scottish authorities agreed that neither side were responsible for the inhabitants. Therefore, anyone was free to rob or kill within the confines of the Debatable Lands, so it became a refuge for the worst of the Reivers from the western marches. By the early 16th century, it was felt that the time was now right to bring the Debatable Lands into the same legal structure as elsewhere on the border. However, neither England nor Scotland could agree exactly where that border was, so the French ambassador was asked to adjudicate. The new frontier was eventually marked by a simple ditch and ran directly east-west and became known as the Scots Dyke, and you can still see signs of this in the landscape today. Now, the Debatable Land might have been violent, but by far the most violent of the marches were the middle marches, and in particular the area known as Liddesdale, which ran for 21 miles to the English border. It was here that lived the most predatory Scottish clans, who frequently launched raids into the English middle march. So lawless was the area that it had its own sub-warden, known as the Keeper of Liddesdale. It is perhaps no surprise that the strongest castle on the border was Hermitage Castle, home of the Keeper. But even with this, by 1569, lawlessness had become so bad that the Regent of Scotland, James Stuart, 1st Earl of Moray, burned every farmstead in Liddesdale, leaving not one house standing. So who were the Reivers? There are 70 predominant family names who can claim to have been Reivers. Both my paternal grandfather and grandmother came from Reiver families who lived in and around Jedburgh, a small Scottish border town in the Middle Marches, which, if you remember, was the bloodiest part of the border. Now, the Border Reiver is a unique figure in British history, but they were not some small minority living in outlaw bands. Rather, they were members of the whole community, a community in 1559 of an estimated population of the English borders of about 117,000 and Scotland of 45,000. They were agricultural labourers, artisans and aristocrats. Members of the community they might be, but they were also rustlers, blackmailers and murderers. Given the hard environment in which they lived, it is no surprise that the borderers are tough and insular people, even today. But today, law and order should just be a 999 call away. Not so in the 16th century. Then the central government was a long distance, and so disputes were resolved locally by their own means. A slight to one member of the clan was a slight to all, and reprisals were swift and long-lasting. Feuds were many, and the interlocking web of clanship led to a web of violence and distrust that lasted for centuries. Even when the feuds were quiet, the Reivers stole from each other, especially when supplies were low. When the wife of one of the most infamous Reivers felt the foodstuffs were running low, she would place a covered plate before her husband. When the cover was removed, there was no food on the plate, just a pair of spurs. It was time to raid or go hungry. Robbery and murder were simply a way of life. Even the local priests carried weapons. Talking of religion, One folk myth is that when a reaver child was baptised, the priest left the hands of the baby unblessed so they could strike an unhallowed blow on the enemy. Religion did not prevent even the most holy of reavers from raiding. Bishop Leslie in 1572 wrote, and I quote, "The reavers' devotion to their rosaries was never greater than before setting out on a raid. And when the authorities realised that there were no churches in that den of iniquity called Liddesdale, they demanded to know, are there no Christians here? To which the answer was, no, just Elliots and Armstrongs. The enemy, of course, could be anyone outside a person's family, and even bitter feuds could be between families on the same side of the border. Families intermarried so much that it was always hard to tell which side you should be on, but a side you had to take or be hunted by both. Border blood was thick, and clan loyalties endured even beyond the Union of the Crowns in 1603. The bond between the borderers was created by geography, common social conditions, a shared spirit of lawless independence, and intermarriage. Intermarriage provided a dual nationality, a nice thing to have if things were getting too hot on one side of the border. A reaver could slip across the frontier to safety to stay with his extended clan. A border official, Thomas Musgrove of Bewcastle, said, and I quote, "They are people that will be Scottish when they will, and English at their pleasure." Now, reaving had its seasons, usually spring and autumn, when the nights were still long and there was plenty of pasture for the horses. The summers and winters were generally quieter, but raiding still occurred. The rural borderer tended to be more mobile, leaving his permanent winter dwellings in around April, before moving to the uplands where they lived for 4 or 5 months while the cattle and sheep were pastured. He learned through generations of warfare and raiding to live on the hoof and created temporary homes out of turf and thatch. In the 16th century, Bishop Leslie of Ross explained that in times of both war and peace, the borders were reduced to poverty. The people saw no future in improving their home comforts, land or possessions, as it would only get destroyed again at the next outburst of violence. Therefore, the only way to improve things was through robbery and murder. Now, it might be surprised for you to find out that there was a code of honour which was respected. Sir Robert Carey, the warden of the English Eastern Middle Marches, wrote to Cecil, Queen Elizabeth's Secretary of State, that the reavers, and I quote, "will rather lose their lives and living than go back from their word and break the custom of the border." But don't go thinking that the reavers were some glorified Robin Hoods. The reavers were aggressive, ruthless, violent people who stole, rustled, ransacked properties, raped and killed. Now, interestingly, although they did kill, especially during a feud, they believed killing in cold blood was an actual crime, so were less likely to kill during a raid, that is, unless the victims resisted. They were also reluctant to provoke a feud, but when one occurred, they were as ready to kill as to do anything. Not quite the romantic borderer as portrayed by Sir Walter Scott. Reaving is a catch-all phrase that covers a full-scale invasion right down to a raid against a single farmhouse. Despite the size of the raid, the objective was always the same. To hit as hard and fast as you could, to take as much plunder as you could carry, and to get home with loot and skin intact. The size of the raid determined how many people would ride. Some of the raids could consist of several hundred riders and could last for days. These were known as outrageous foraging. Smaller raids of a handful of men might be a moonlight ride, a quick plunder, and disappear back to their homes. But these were not just mindless hoodlums. The leader of the raid would plot his route, know how much time it would take, and how quickly his victims and their allies might respond. To give an example of a raid, I have chosen one led by Sir Walter Scott. No, not that Sir Walter Scott. Walter Scott is an exceptionally common name on the borders. This Sir Walter Scott was known as Wicked Wat, a nobleman of the Scottish borders and chief of Clan Scott. He was apparently, and I quote, "an inveterate English hater, brave, arrogant, treacherous, and a murderer without conscience." Born and bred in the borders, Walter was perhaps the iconic reaver. In the 1530s, this Sir Walter Scott led a raid of some 120 reavers against the home of one William Routledge living in the English West March. Scott made off with 40 head of cows and oxen, as well as 20 horses. As they headed for the border, being chased by the local militia, Scott sprung an ambush where the Reavers killed several English soldiers as well as a local magistrate. It was a textbook raid, a carefully chosen target, trusty companions who were well armed, the element of surprise, and the sense to anticipate pursuit and a plan to deal with it. Incidents like this kept the Borders up in arms, and some had far-reaching consequences. In 1513, the Scottish Warden of the Middle Marches swept into Northumberland at the head of 6,000 men to revenge the death of a previous warden. Unfortunately, on the way home with the loot, they were soundly beaten by the English forces. This prompted James IV of Scotland to become ever more belligerent with England, which led to his death and Scottish military disaster, as I mentioned before, at the Battle of Flodden Field. You can see that reaving, although a way of life, was not without its perils. The main towns were well defended and local watches were formed. The roads and passes that were provided escape routes were routinely patrolled by the warden's men. These militias chained up bridges to force the raiders to cross rivers at fords that were well guarded. In addition, there was a network of beacons manned by the militia to give warning of an approaching raid. One beacon warned of approaching riders, two beacons lit that they were riding fast, and four that they came in strength. On the return trip from a raid was a time when the reaver was most vulnerable. They had to move more slowly when encumbered with loot and rustled livestock. To that end, they rarely returned the same way they had come, and tried to avoid the main passes across the border, much preferring to go across country. Bishop Leslie of Ross has left us with perhaps the best description of a raid, and I quote it at length. "They sally out of their own borders in the night in troops, through unfrequented byways and many intricate windings. All the time they refresh themselves and their horses in lurking places they have pitched upon before, till they arrive in the dark at those places they have designs upon. As soon as they have seized upon the booty, they in like manner return home in the night through blind ways, fetching many a compass. The more skilful any captain is to pass through those wild deserts, crooked turnings and deep precipices, in the thickest mists and darkness, his reputation is the greater." If the Borders were Britain's Wild West, so too was a response to a raid. In the US in the 19th century, it was the posse. In the Borderlands in the 16th century, it was the Hot Trod. I quite like that name, the Hot Trod. The Hot Trod was the hot pursuit of the Reavers and was allowed under border law on both sides, even though it was more in keeping with Scottish law than English common law. The victims of a raid could, within 6 days, follow the Reavers with hound and horn and cross the border for recovery of their goods. A piece of burning turf was held aloft on a spear point, and this announced the trod, and all neighbours aged 16 to 60 were duty bound to join the pursuit. In fact, if they didn't, they were considered to be a traitor and would have to become a fugitive themselves. But even if everyone rode on the hot trod and it successfully caught up with the raiders, that was not the end of the matter. Because the miscreants had now become victims themselves and could lawfully call out a hot trod to reclaim their lost ill-gotten gains. Reprisal led to reprisal and sometimes to full-blooded feud. Most feuds were the result of a death on a raid or a hot trod. Then the whole family became involved to gain revenge on the killer and his extended family. The feuds could last for generations, while others were settled in a cataclysmic battle or single combat. Sometimes families had feuds against more than one rival at the same time. Often, the authorities stood back and let the feud play out, as usually this resulted in troublesome families killing each other off, and therefore reduced the trouble on the border. But equally, the feud system quite often prevented a swift response from law and order, as many were too afraid to invoke a vendetta by killing a reaver. Far better to lose a few cattle than be involved in a mindless feud. To end long-running feuds, the authorities sometimes allowed feuding families to settle things in a fight within certain restrictions. For example, the Collingwood-Byrne feud was to be settled by a free-for-all, so long as each side only brought 6 family members to the fight. However, James IV of Scotland had to step in when it transpired that the Collingwoods were not bringing 6, but 1,200 to the fight. Some feuds lasted generations, For example, the Heron Curfew lasted for well over 60 years in the mid-16th century, the principals in the feud being long dead, but the families still hated each other. The Maxwell-Johnson feud was one of the bitterest, with both sides fighting to become top dog in the Scottish Western March. It was finally settled by the Battle of Dryfe Sands near Lockerbie in 1593, when the Johnsons, outnumbered 5-1 but with more horsemen, unleashed a deadly charge and routed the Maxwell foot soldiers. A downward, backhanded cut to the head of an enemy on foot became known as the Lockerbie Lick after this clash. Now, there were so many feuds, I'm not certain how families kept track of who was friend or foe. Now, if you remember, I mentioned my family were the Olivers and the Simpsons. However, we were the retainers of the Kerr family. They were quite busy having lots and lots and lots of feuds, so I think we probably had our hands full. As we've already seen how the word bereaved originated with the Reavers, and so is another word, blackmail. Mail is derived from a Scandinavian word, mál, meaning agreement. Black may be a Gaelic word meaning to protect. Blackmail originally was therefore a protection racket paid by the landowner to stop his livestock being driven off, his homestead burnt, and his family killed. Usually this was paid in kind, cattle, sheep, oats or barley, very rarely money, as money was always in short supply. For most landowners, without recourse to the protection of the law, it was the only protection they had from the reaver. And it worked relatively okay, until 1567, when a Scottish Act was introduced making paying blackmail punishable by death. So pay it and die, or don't pay it and die. Eventually sense was seen, and the Scottish law amended to just imprisonment. Like blackmail, kidnapping was a thriving border industry. It was undertaken either for ransom or to get something in return. One of the best examples I found of this is the Pertrie brothers, or maybe Petrie brothers. The sources vary. Watty Pertrie was arrested for horse stealing, so his brother Jock kidnapped the 6-year-old son of the local sheriff and threatened to hang the child if Watty wasn't released. Watty was of course freed, and the boy returned unharmed to his father. Now, it may come as a surprise, because I've mentioned several times that the borders were a lawless den of inequity, but there were some attempts to implement law and order from both the English and Scottish crowns. In particular, there was a special border law called the March Law, recognised by both sides, which was maintained by the wardens. March Law was introduced in the 13th century to deal with cross-border disputes. Essentially, they were a set of regulations for the prosecution of offences committed by inhabitants of one country inside the territory of another. The law was upheld at regular courts held on so-called days of truce, periodic gatherings of plaintiffs and defendants held at pre-arranged spots near the border. The March Laws were a mishmash of Scottish legal practices, English common law, military law, and usually the warden's own version of all three. Despite long periods of unrest and reluctance of the borderers to abide by them, the March Laws were enforced until the early 17th century. Now, neither the English nor the Scottish crowns particularly liked the ideas of March Laws, far preferring to use their own laws, but found it impossible to enforce their own laws given the certain peculiarities of the borders. Namely, firstly, that it was the impossibility of using the common law to obtain redress and reparation from those who gave allegiance to another country. Secondly, the constant warfare or threat of warfare, as well as the threat of armed raiders, meant that judges were reluctant to travel north to carry out their duties. Thirdly, the existence of a discrete borderland province where allegiance were not so much to Scotland and England, rather to their more local family clans. Fourthly, the fluidity of the border itself, as wrongdoers that could simply cross the border to avoid justice. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the lack of rural landholdings in the borders led to a reliance on the local family and the local clan chiefs, who were often knee-deep in the violence themselves. Now, despite these factors, March law was seen by the monarchs of the two countries as being supplemental to their respective laws and not as a substitute. The March law was finally abolished when the Union of the Crowns took place in 1603 and James VI of Scotland and I of England dealt a final blow to the Border Reavers. Each March, not March the geographical area, not March the month, was administered by a warden whose duty it was to defend the frontier from invasion during wartime and to provide law and order in times of peace. The latter a role they very often failed to deliver on, as the wardens were as lawless as the reavers. The English wardens were appointed from the southern counties of England, so they had no familiar connections to influence their judgment. However, the salary of a warden was not sufficient to keep him and his family in any comfort. The English warden, therefore, had to supplement his income somehow, and not usually by fair means. The Scottish wardens were more transparent. They were the local lairds and favoured their own. Now, it's true that the Scottish wardens knew more about their area and the rival families than their English counterparts, but they were also usually knee-deep in the local feuds. Now, when the warden felt inclined, or if the crown became uneasy with the lawless frontier, then the wardens would pursue the reavers, who would be fined, evicted, or hung. However, no sooner had the reaver been hung, the fines levied, and the evictions carried out, then the raiding began all over again. As with the March laws, the office of warden became unnecessary after the Union of the Crowns in 1603. Trustees were when the wardens of both sides met to redress grievances and bring justice to the borders. The English usually crossed into Scotland, as early in the 16th century a Scottish warden had been murdered at a trustee on English ground. So the Scots, and I quote, swore they would never have to come on English ground for justice. But as we will see, this was not a fixed rule, and the Scots did cross over occasionally. Trustees grew beyond just a purely legal practice and became an opportunity for villagers on both sides of the border to take part in trading and to attend local markets. Not surprisingly, these market days usually degenerated into a drunken, bloody brawl, often leading to more feuds, leading to more violence, leading to more court cases, leading to more days of truce, leading to more drunken brawls, leading to, you get the idea. Based on the legal indentures of 1398 that set up these truce days, they should have been held monthly, but this was rarely the case. Firstly, because the hostility of the English crown to the March laws, unless absolutely necessary. Secondly, the increase of violence amongst the border magnates disrupted the workings of the law. And thirdly, the mutual dislike between the opposing wardens was often enough to cause extensive delays. In terms of the places designated for the days of truce, most were on the Scottish side of the border. Places in Scotland such as Redenburn, Lochmaben and Reedswire were used. In England, Carlisle, Rockcliffe and Berwick-upon-Tweed are mentioned in the sources. Once the place and date had been arranged, the bills of complaint were presented to the warden. These were then passed on to the warden of the opposite march and the accused were summoned. Defendants were either found guilty, innocent, or assumed guilty if they failed to turn up. The truce period was supposed to last until sunrise of the day after the day of truce, although occasionally this did not happen. Ostensibly, March law was used as a dispute settlement procedure. However, the days of truce and the use of March law also had a political and diplomatic dimension. Not least, the contact between the wardens of both sides helped to maintain a back channel between the two crowns. Now, the March law did not stop raiding across the border, but it did offer a safety valve that prevented such raids from breaking out into open warfare. It was the only mechanism that offered any chance of compensation for losses and the apprehending of cross-border fugitives. But there were times when the border people, or even the wardens, took the law into their own hands and administered what became known as Jeddah justice, so called because of the extreme use of this in the area around Jeddah in the Scottish Middle March. Jeddah is the name that Jeddah is known to the local inhabitants. The ethos of Jeddah justice was simple: hang first, ask questions later. Obviously, it also led to further feuds, when families believed a loved one had been hung without being guilty of any crime. Now, there is an old Simpson-Oliver family myth that one of my ancestors was a victim of Jeddah justice, but like most of the border myths, I have been unable to corroborate this in fact. The effectiveness of March law depended heavily on the energy and probity of the warden. The verdicts given were open to abuse if the warden or his officers were in cahoots with the reavers. An indication of how ineffective the March laws could be are the simple facts that the kinship ties between the border clans meant oaths to a court meant very little. The wardens could often not trust their own officers to carry out their orders. There were several threats to potential witnesses, witness tampering, I believe it's called today, the use of blackmail and kidnapping to try to alter judgments, and the collusion of some of the local lairds and wardens. It's not surprising that the March law could and did sometimes work surprisingly well, but it was at best a finger in the dyke. It was also true that the Scottish Anglo border laws were self-defeating. They were in themselves a recognition of abnormality, and at worst they even encouraged it. Despite the best attempts of the wardens and the March law, the borders, with the exception of the Scottish Highlands, were the last part of Britain to be brought under the rule of law. The borderers were always great fighting men. They were recruited into the armies of both Scotland and England. And in times of war between the countries, it could become very much a border affair, with reavers providing large numbers of light cavalry to either side. For example, the battles of Otterburn in 1388, Flodden Field in 1513, and Solway Moss in 1542 are all linked with large numbers of reavers active on both sides. However, it may come as no surprise that their loyalty was always questionable, and there are numerous examples of reaver troops switching sides so they could join their old family clan. The role of the reaver in warfare was basically the same as in their everyday life, that of light cavalry. The reavers scouted for the army, ambushed enemy's patrols, rustled his livestock, stole supplies and provisions, plundered towns and villages, and when victorious, hunted down the fleeing soldiers. It should therefore come as no surprise that in their day job as reavers, that raids were planned like military operations. Some of the raids could involve large numbers of armed men and last for several days. More modest raids might involve no more than a few riders with a short moonlit ride, a quick plunder from a small farm, followed by a dash home for breakfast. A reaver's choice of weapons and clothing and horses therefore had to allow him to move with speed. The elements of surprise, boldness and cunning were necessary for a successful raid. Great importance was placed on the reaver's mount. The horses used were called hobblers and were shaggy little ponies, but sure-footed and unshod. They chose horses for agility and stamina rather than looks. In Scotland, this pony is called a Galloway, and in England, rather ungracefully, it's called a nag or a bog trotter. Robust the horse might be, but the reaver also gave it added protection by placing small chains around its thighs and chest to deflect spear thrusts. The reaver usually wore armour of some description. Full armour was too cumbersome and too expensive, so for most reavers their equipment were either hand-me-downs or stripped from dead opponents. The most common armour was a sleeveless jacket made from two or three layers of quilted cloth interlaced with small iron or horn plates. There was no leg armour. Usually the rider would simply have thigh-length riding boots and spurs. Both on foot and riding, they also carried a small round shield for protection. For the head and neck, a scarf was wrapped repeatedly around the neck to prevent a sneak attack from behind aiming to cut your throat. On the head, originally the reaver only wore a small cap, but as the 16th century dawned, metal helmets were worn to protect the upper face and neck. These are the famous steel bonnets, light open helmets that provided protection without loss of vision. They were peaked on top to deflect a downward sword cut, had a flared rim to protect the neck, and had protective cheek plates. For the horsemen, the preferred weapon was the lang spear, a wooden shaft of about 10 foot long, topped with a metal spike. A similar weapon was used by the footmen of each side, and this was of course the pike, but the pike could be up to 16 feet in length. Another favourite, especially for the Scots of the Middlemarch, was the Jeddart staff, a 4-foot blade of steel on a wooden pole. It had a long cutting edge and a spike at the handle end and was used to pierce armour on a fallen foe. As a young boy visiting Jedburgh, I saw one of these hanging over a fireplace. My relatives told me with great glee that it had killed many Englishmen. It certainly made an impression on a 7-year-old boy. For personal protection, most reavers carried a basket-hilted broadsword, while the nobility wore rapiers and parrying daggers. Everyone carried a long, narrow dagger called a dirk, including the clergy, who were not above joining in some of the raids and getting their hands dirty. Projectile weapons changed with the times. The English, of course, favoured the longbow, while the Scots preferred a small crossbow called a latch. Pistol and muskets were slowly introduced across the 16th century, but they were slow to reload, prone to misfire, and not accurate unless you were within 20 paces. The inhabitants of the borders had to live in a state of constant alert, and for self-protection, those who could afford it built fortified dwellings. English Acts of Parliament in 1555 and 1584 legislated that all fortresses, castles and towers within 20 miles of the border were to be put in good shape and all open ground to be enclosed by hedges and ditches to deter the raiders. And the Scots were no less prepared, as according to a Scottish statute of 1535, large landowners in the borderlands were required to build a wall of stone and lime, 60 square feet in area, in which they were expected to construct a dwelling. There were several types of defensive buildings on the borders. The largest are, of course, the castles, erected by both sides as a first point of attack and defence. The two best known are Hermitage and Ferniehirst castles. Today, Hermitage Castle is partly ruined, but has a reputation as one of the most sinister and atmospheric castles in Scotland, in part due to its association with witchcraft, and because it was also known as the guardhouse of the bloodiest valley in Britain, which is Liddesdale in Scotland. Built around 1240 as Motton Bailey, its first family's occupation ended in 1320 when they were accused of witchcraft. Owned by both English and Scottish nobility, it was rebuilt in the 15th century and was for a time home to James Hepburn, 4th Earl of Bothwell, lover and later husband of Mary, Queen of Scots. Its last occupier was a famous reaver known as the Bold Buccleuch, of whom much more later. The castle slowly fell into disrepair throughout the 17th century. Ferniehirst Castle lies just over a mile away from Jedburgh. Built in the 15th century by the Kerr family, it is still their private home, belonging to the future 14th Marquess of Lothian, and is open to the public every July. Like Hermitage's, it has a bloody past. It was fought over repeatedly during the Rough Wooing in the 1540s, and saw at least one garrison put to the sword. Similarly, in the 1570s and 1590s, it was attacked by both English and Scottish forces. An interesting architectural feature is that the staircases are built in a left-handed spiral to give better protection to left-handed swordsmen, as apparently the Kerrs had a disposition to be left-handed. Left-handed people in Scotland are still called Kerr-handed today. Apart from castles, there were two other types of fortified dwelling to be found on the frontier. The Tower House, which was the home of the border lord, and the Bastle, which was lived in by more prosperous farmers. Smailholm Tower near Kelso is probably the best example of a tower house on the borders. A border tower house, sometimes referred to as a peel tower, was built of stone and mortar and enclosed by a stone wall called a barmkin. The barmkin was used to keep the castle and sheep close to the house and was about 15 feet high and 3 feet thick. Outbuildings were built inside the barmkin for storage, stabling and to house retainers of the lord. The roof was steeply pitched and tiled with stone and often enclosed by a parapet. This provided some protection while the defenders hurled stones or boiling water on the attackers. There were few windows in this structure, as the emphasis of the buildings was on security and not good lighting. Towers usually comprised of a basement and 2 or 3 floors of living space. The basement was used to secure the livestock when the tower was being attacked. The first floor was a general living space encompassing a couple of rooms, including a kitchen and a fireplace. The second and third floors, if they had them, would be used for sleeping and storage and led to the roof. The upper floors were reached by a staircase, with the stairs often having a trip step built in, one step slightly steeper than the rest, which would cause the attacker to stumble as they climbed the stairs and therefore allow the defender to strike. The staircase at the top of each floor could also be blocked. If the tower had to be abandoned in the face of an armed attack, then it would be stuffed with peat, which was set on fire and caused a thick, dense, smouldering smoke. The defenders would then attempt to escape in the reduced visibility, hoping to return after the invaders had left. One way to take the towers was called scum fishing. This was hacking through the outer doors and heaping wet straws into the doorway and against the walls. It was then set on fire and the defenders could be smoked out. Alternatively, the attackers would use scaling ladders, get to the top of the tower and uncover the roof. Then the men could jump together into the top room. However, this was extremely risky, as it usually ended in the death of the people jumping in. Mostly stealth and surprise were used to win the tower house. One of the best examples of a battle house is Black Middens, which lies about 7 miles northwest of Bellingham in Northumberland. The battle house was a strong two-storey building with stone walls over 3 feet thick. The roof was steeply pitched and covered with stone slabs. Again, the basement was a shelter for livestock and had a strong door which was bolted from the inside. A trapdoor in the ceiling was the only means to reach the upper floor from the basement. The upper floor usually had 2 or 3 rooms, but again very few windows, with only narrow arrow slits providing light and ventilation. The upper floors would be reached by a stone staircase, but any stairs ended at heavily bolted doors. Of course, most of the farm labourers, including the Oliver Simpson family, lived in crude turf cabins and had to run to the tower or battle house in times of strife, leaving any possessions they had to the reavers. There are many famous reavers, all immortalised in ballad and folklore along the borders, but do not fall for the romanticised version peddled by Sir Walter Scott. They were all hard and dangerous men. Perhaps the best example is Geordie Byrne, a notorious reaver who on the night before he was hung in 1597 admitted, and I quote, he had raped above 40 men's wives, that he had killed 7 Englishmen with his own hand, cruelly murdering them, that he had spent his whole time in whoring, drinking, stealing, and taking deep revenge for slight offences. Nice guy. Most of the reavers we hear about were the leaders. Their retainers are less well known, but suffered the same fate as their lords, as in this next story. Johnny Armstrong was the Laird of Glennockie in Dumfries and Galloway and had a good reputation north of the border, as it was alleged that he had never injured a fellow Scotsman. However, to the English, he was the devil incarnate. It was said there were no estates from the Scottish border to Newcastle-upon-Tyne who did not pay him protection money. Despite having no formal source of income, he led a band of up to 160 men on raids deep into England, including one bloody raid in 1527 that tore to the village of Netherby in Cumberland, killing all the local inhabitants. Despite appeals for his arrest from the English warden, he was never apprehended because he was under the protection of a family member who was Lord Robert Maxwell, the warden of the Scottish West March. Armstrong was seen by the English court of Henry VIII as being particularly troublesome, and so a complaint was made to the new Scottish king, James V. Now, James V saw Johnny as a hindrance to diplomacy, and as one of his priorities was to restore order and to pacify the borders, Johnny was proscribed as a rebel in 1529 and excommunicated. However, in 1530, just 1 year later, James V ordered all his leading magnates to meet at Teviotdale and Annandale for a spot of hunting. The king offered safe conduct to Johnny Armstrong for an audience to discuss how peace could be returned to the borders. When Johnny and his men came into the king's presence, however, they were seized. Johnny is said to have shouted at the king, "I have asked grace from a graceless face." There was no trial. Johnny and his 36 men were hung in the trees of Caerlanrigg Church. A memorial to Armstrong and his men stand to this day in the chapel graveyard. But this strong man act backfired for James V, as instead of showing his strength, the betrayal and execution of Johnny Armstrong weakened James's authority in the borders. He lost the trust of the leading border families, and so the borders became ungovernable from Edinburgh. And even today, there is little love of the Edinburgh government in the borders. Just for reference, the borders voted 2-1 against Scottish independence in 2014. Old Wat was another notorious border reaver along the Anglo-Scottish border in the 16th century, who also shared Walter Scott's name. This Wat, a different Wat to the other Wat, was born in 1550 into the powerful branch of the Scott clan and became an infamous freebooter whose only allegiance was to his family. Wat led raids against both the English and Scottish, an equal opportunity reaver, if you like. In 1567, Wat married Mary Scott, known as the Flower of Yarrow. When supplies were low, it is she who allegedly presented a set of spurs on a plate instead of meat. In 1592, he was one of those charged with taking part in the attempt to capture King James VI of Scotland at Falkland Palace, and for that was declared a rebel and outlaw, and had all his houses demolished. But this did not slow down his reaving. On to Old Wat, and he is said to have used bugle horn to summon his armed soldiers to his side. It has been memorialised in ballads and fiction, as in this extract from Sir Walter Scott's The Reaver's Wedding. I will now attempt a Scottish accent to read this bit out. He took a bugle frae his side, wee names called o'er and o'er. He blew a note both sharp and high, till rock and water rang around. 3 scores of moss troopers have mounted at that bugle sound. More on the moss troopers later. Let us now look at some of the exploits of these border warriors. The raid of the Reeds Wire took place on the 7th of July 1575 at the Carter Bar, the Cheviot Pass which enters Reedsdale and forms the border between England and Scotland. The skirmish was between the English wardens, Sir John Forster, and the Scottish warden, Sir John Carmichael. It was the first Anglo-Scottish battle since the Battle of Pinkie in 1547, and it was also the last battle between the independent kingdoms of England and the Kingdom of Scotland. All later battles were after the Union of the Crowns in 1603. The two wardens of the Middle Marches met at a hill called Reedswire in Carter Bar for a regularly scheduled truce day, where the two discussed matters that came up between their two regions. Both men were accompanied by armed guards. One of the cases up for discussion was an Englishman who was supposedly in the English warden's custody. The Scottish warden demanded that the man be delivered for justice, but it was alleged that the thief had escaped from custody and could not be produced. This turned into an argument, with both sides hurling increasingly personal insults at each other, until members of the English contingent could no longer hold their temper and attacked, killing 2 Scotsmen and wounding several others. The Scots had no choice but took to their horses and fled along the valley floor. Fortunately for them, a group from Jedburgh, who were late to the meeting, crested the ridge and, surveying the scene below them, put spur to horse and charged into the flank of the English riders, giving a shout now famous across the borders, "Jeddits here!" The English were routed, with the English warden and several others nobles captured and 25 Englishmen killed. The prisoners were brought to James Douglas, 4th Earl of Morton, who was regent for the boy King of Scotland, James VI. He immediately recognised the political implication and the risk of all-out war, so he quickly resolved the issue and the English-Scottish crowns came to an amicable solution. All of the English prisoners were released unharmed. The story of the skirmish became folklore, and in my case, family lore. Another Simpson Oliver family legend, with absolutely no proof I can find, as that one of my ancestors was involved in the charge of the Jedburgh men. If that is true or not, what is true is that the event was turned into a border ballad, edited and published by Sir Walter Scott in 1802. Also, on the Cheviot Hills, near the place where the battle was fought, there is a monument known as the Reedswire Stone. This was built in commemoration of the battle. It reads, "On this ridge, July the 7th, 1575, was fought one of the last border raids known as the Raid of the Reedswire." But it was far from the last border raid. One of the most daring reaver raids was the rescue of Kinmont Willie from Carlisle Castle in 1596. Willie Armstrong, aka Kinmont Willie, was a notorious reaver who led a particularly violent gang of 300 men known as the Kinmont Bairns. In 1591, he carried off his most daring raid by falling on Tynedale in Northumberland, where he took over 2,000 head of livestock and £300 in cash. He became a much wanted man, and the English warden was prepared to wait to get his revenge. It took 5 years before, in 1596, the English warden struck. On a truce day, Willie had been riding on the Scottish side of the border when he had been surprised by a posse of 200 English riders. He quickly took flight, but was shot when the posse, in violation of the truce day, crossed the border and pursued him before running him down. Bound in chains, Willie was taken to the English stronghold Carlisle Castle. The capture of Willie saw tempers run hot in the borders, and when the English warden rejected the Scottish warden's complaint, things took a turn for the violent. Unfortunately for the English, the Scottish warden was Sir Walter Scott, another Sir Walter Scott. This Sir Walter Scott was from Branxholme, and he was Keeper of Liddesdale and Laird of Buccleuch, known to the history as the Bold Buccleuch. As befits his nickname, he put in motion a bold plan to pull off one of the greatest exploits in Reaver history. He sent a woman to visit Willie in the castle, and through this spy discovered exactly where he was incarcerated, how many men guarded him, and the routine of the garrison. He then summoned his retainers to meet him 10 miles from Carlisle. The force consisted of 200 horsemen, sufficient for the rescue, but too few to provoke a war between England and Scotland. Buccleuch sent out a small scouting party to reconnoitre the path to the border and beyond. These were followed by an advance body of about 40 men who were to intercept anyone that the scouts discovered. The advance guard was then followed by the main group of about 150 horsemen, carrying ladders and equipment to break down walls and gates. Getting to Carlisle Castle unobserved, Buccleuch divided his forces into three. The first group, keeping open their escape route. The second, positioning itself between the castle and the town to dissuade any townsfolk who wanted to interfere. And the third, as the main force to breach the castle. Now, things didn't start off too well, as the rescuers soon discovered that the ladders were not long enough. So they proceeded to plan B and simply battered down a small sallyport gate. The gate was quickly broken and the gatekeeper taken prisoner. In the flickering torchlight, the rescue party located Willie, thanks to the intelligence gathered by Buccleuch's agent. Reaching him, though, was one thing. Getting away from one of the heaviest defended castles in England was quite another. As soon as Willie was liberated, the rescue party sounded a trumpet. This was a signal to their associates outside of the castle to make as much noise as possible. On hearing the clamour, the English defenders locked themselves within the barracks and would later claim they'd been attacked by well over 500 men, when only about 80 had actually entered the castle. The castle was completely open to be plundered, but Buccleuch was there for one reason, and one reason only, to free Willie. So in less than 2 hours from their silent approach, the victorious Reavers rode out of Carlisle. They got away scot-free, if you'll pardon the pun. It is claimed that Buccleuch had an understanding with the English Graham family, who lived across their escape route, and could have ambushed them on their way back. Now this is possible, because King Montmilly was related to the Graham family. Another theory is that Buccleuch had bribed some of the English guards when his female agent had visited Willie. No one knows for sure, but Willie had been rescued in a daring raid, and a raid that had dented the superiority of the English. In anger, the English warden launched a counter-raid into the borders, razed to the ground the towns of Annan and Dumfries, and took well over 200 prisoners. The ripples of the attack quickly spread to Elizabeth I of England. The report she received greatly exaggerated the number of Scots involved and the number of casualties sustained by the English garrison. Now, this was a time when both England and Scotland were seeking a diplomatic détente, and she was embarrassed and angered, both by Buccleuch's raid, but also by her warden's response, which she felt had been an overreaction. Despite this, she demanded James VI of Scotland send Buccleuch to London to face questioning. James was caught between allegiance to the Scots, who were adamant Buccleuch had done no wrong in rescuing a man who was captured illegally, and in James's desire to pander to his English benefactor, Elizabeth. Elizabeth threatened to suspend a yearly subsidy she paid to James and to review the succession plan, which currently had James as her heir. James's prevaricating risked war, but in a typically bold manner, Buccleuch ignored his king's dithering and freely rode to meet Queen Elizabeth in London. The audience between Buccleuch and Elizabeth has gone down in history. She asked him, "How dare you undertake such a dangerous and presumptuous venture?" Buccleuch replied, "What does a man dare not do?" She was taken with this reply and answered, "With 10,000 such men, our brother of Scotland might shake the firmest thrones in Europe." Buccleuch the Bold was allowed to return to Scotland unharmed. Kinmont Willie returned to his ways, but was never taken prisoner again, and allegedly died an old man in his bed. But just 7 short years distanced the rescue of Kinmont Willie and the beginning of the end of the Reavers. The death of Elizabeth and the coronation of James VI and I in 1603 spelled doom to the freewheeling life of the Border Reaver. Yet to begin with, it didn't feel like it. In the first few weeks after Elizabeth's death, the border shook loose once again, with raiding, looting and burning. The Reavers believed that the death of a monarch meant anarchy until the new monarch was crowned. Unfortunately for the border way of life, James acted decisively before his coronation. He issued a proclamation against all the rebels. No supplies would be given to them or their wives and children, and the rebels would be prosecuted with fire and sword. James required all who were guilty of, and I quote, "foul and insolent outrages lately committed in the borders," to submit themselves to his mercy under penalty of being exiled forever. James then sent a strong force to the borders to deal with the havoc so that his triumphant entry into England would not be marred. The Reavers were chased back into their stronghold, and then James ordered all places of strength to be demolished and ordered all the inhabitants to become simple farmers. Even the name Borders was prohibited. The area was simply to be known as the Middle Shires. James VI decided to take an even harsher hand in dealing with the border lairds. Lords Johnson, Buccleuch, Bothwell and other minor chiefs were sent to prison for a short time in a disciplinary clean sweep. They had failed to keep order, had committed outrages themselves and had protected the Reavers. James also decreed that the border marches would cease to exist and the office of warden to be abolished. In its place, James set up a commission of 10 men, 5 from each side, to administer the pacification of the Reavers. The commission were given unlimited powers. The march laws were abolished, and it was proclaimed, and I quote, "If any Englishman steal in Scotland, or any Scotsman steal in England, any goods or castle, he shall be punished by death." The most blatant offenders were rounded up and summarily executed without trial, an example of extreme Jeddah justice. Sir George Home was one of the men appointed to the commission, and he was exceptionally ruthless, hanging over 140 of the most powerful Reavers in all the border. Now, the Reavers had endured such purges before, but this time the border lairds joined in the proceedings against their own kinsmen. After his release from jail, Buccleuch himself hanged many of his old comrades and pressed many more into military service. Naturally, the Reaving families bitterly resented the commission. With disregard to the orders that had been issued, the Armstrongs and Elliots mounted a raid on Reedsdale. Because of this, they were singled out for a particularly harsh punishment and were permanently exiled to Ireland, where they were forced to scrape out a living on the worst of the moors and bogs. The Graham family were pressed into military service in the Netherlands. Tynedale and Reedsdale families were conscripted for service in Ireland, and more were sent to fight in the Bohemian Wars. They were all told that the death penalty awaited them should they desire to return home. Many others were transported to the colonies, which is why many Americans can trace their lineage to the harsh beauty of the borderlands. The raiding families were now to be judged by the same laws as the rest of the nation. The central government had now been combined into one, and the Reavers could no longer play England against Scotland. During the first year of James's reign, thousands of executions on the borders took place, and 10,000 more were banished. Those that were left on the borders now faced being driven from their own lands, since the gentry, believing it would now be safe to reside on the borders, wanted the land for themselves. Although kinships were broken and owning a horse or weapons forbidden, traditions of reaving and feuding were still alive. Eventually, however, even this began to dwindle, for there were fewer places for the reaver to hide or to seek sanctuary. The common people were simply desperate for peace. So had peace come to the borders? Moss troopers are often mistaken as reavers, even by Sir Walter Scott in the poem I read out earlier, but they are in fact a separate group of villains altogether. Moss troopers were brigands of the mid-17th century who operated across the border country between Scotland and England during the period of the Commonwealth until just after the Restoration. Much like the border reavers, moss troopers do not have a clear genesis. Mention of them appears in historical records and gives the false impression that they appeared unexpectedly. In fact, most of the moss troopers were ex-soldiers for one of the armies of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, the English Civil Wars. They had kept their weapons and lived a life of brigandage, attacking both civilians and soldiers for supplies during the years of the interregnum. The first statute to deal with them was passed after the Restoration by the Cavalier Parliament in 1662, but it was the Moss Trooper Act of 1666 which finally brought some level of peace to the borders. This rigorously imposed the death penalty or permanent transportation to America. And so the reavers and moss troopers were consigned to history, but their memory was kept alive in the border ballads and folk tales. Although the reavers' conduct was deplorable, many now look back through the mists of time and remember the reaver as a brave, forceful, fighting man, and even somewhat romantic in the passage of time, and always ready to ride in the moonlight. Anglo-Scottish border ballads are a group of songs in a long tradition of balladry. They were sung unaccompanied and without a chorus. A popular theme, of course, was the recounting of raids, battles and reavers. One of the most popular ballads retells the story of Kinmont Willie and his daring rescue from Carlisle Castle, while another tells of the treacherous death of Johnny Armstrong. As you would expect, it is Sir Walter Scott, and I mean Sir Walter Scott this time, who romanticised the borders and gave the noble reaver a far more alluring appeal than they ever deserved. However, he also saved many of the ballads from obscurity. In 1802, he first published his Minstrelsy of the Scottish Borders. Later in the 19th century, Francis James Child collected them as part of his famous anthology of British folk songs. Of the 305 ballads in the Child collection, over 10% are border ballads. A.L. Lloyd, an English folk singer and a collector of folk songs, has said of the border ballads, and I quote, "The bare rolling stretch of country from the North Tyne and Cheviots to the Scottish southern uplands was for a long time the territory of men who spoke English but had the outlook of Afghan tribesmen. They prized a poem almost as much as plunder and produced such an impressive assembly of local narrative songs that some people used to label all our greater folk poems as border ballads." There are many reminders of the reavers in the borders today. Coachloads of American tourists trying to piece together their fractured family history drive through the borders absolutely convinced they are related to one of the famous reaver families. They visit Carlisle Castle, where the names of the most famous are etched into the floor and scour to find their own. The game of Hanba, where a ball, which is supposedly represents the head of an English reaver, is chased up and down by a mob on Jebra High Street every February. My dad played this game for several years before leaving the borders for good in 1943 when he joined the Royal Artillery. But it is the summertime when the myths and legends in the borders truly come to life. Summer in Scotland marks the celebrations known as the Common Ridings, during which time the border towns organise ceremonies to confirm the boundaries of the towns. In centuries gone by, these were necessary to ensure that no one had encroached on the land. Today, these old perambulations are known as Common Ridings of the Marches and are enacted as a public ceremony. The Common Ridings celebrate each border town's history and tradition in midsummer, during a period spanning May to September. Rideouts involve hundreds of horses, often ridden in costume, to evoke a passion worthy of the reavers of old. Hoik is traditionally the start of the season, since a regiment from Hoik captured a flag from an English army in 1514. Borderers have long memories. As well as Hoik, common ridings take place in many border towns. Each town started celebration in the spring with the election of that year's principal, or callant. The callant plays a leading role in the riding out, and once elected, they are honoured figures until the end of this ceremonial season. During the Jebra ride out, held on the first Saturday in July, the Reedswire Raid is commemorated, as a Jeddah Callant broaches the ridge near the Carter Bar and gallops towards the Reedswire Stone, they give that immortal battle cry of "Jeddah's here." Now, while a lot of the Simpson Oliver family myths you've heard today are just that, myths, my relative Jim Oliver, in about 1973, as the Jeddah Callant, which was a great honour for my family. And so the memory of the Border Reaver remains alive to this day. History has become legend.
This podcast has been produced by the Mr. T Podcast Studio in association with the Farnham U3A World History Group. Thank you very much for listening to this talk.